Who's Talking is brought to you by University Square, a collection of locally owned high-end shops and restaurants offering unique products and free storefront parking. Visit University Square on Franklin Street, downtown Chapel Hill. University Square. See you there.
Now, here's D.G. Martin on WCHL.
Welcome to Who's Talking. This is D.G. Martin. Well, Tom Drew is an innovative and nationally respected fundraising counsel and consultant, and that's important. But he's also a political guru and a sports nut, an insider really at Duke and at Carolina, and one of the most popular guests on Who's Talking. And Tom Drew, welcome back.
It's been a while.
You've been busy raising money for everybody.
Yeah, I've run around the country.
I'm at a loss on both my political and sports bedrock. And so thanks for coming in to visit with me today. And so I'm interested, first of all, in politics, okay, and state politics. I've watched, and all of us have watched, sort of the beginning of the sort of implementation of this new regime in Raleigh after the Republican Party took charge of both the state Senate and the state House. You're able to put this in the context of national politics. And what do you see happening? What should we look for? What are the news stories that will break during the next month or two with respect to the new legislature?
Well, it is fascinating because it's the first time they've had the Senate since before 1900, you know, really. And so you see the leadership there saying they're going to have a state budget by June 1. I mean, you and I have both seen sessions that go past Labor Day, you know. And so I think they're going to be very cut and dried, unemotional about what they do. It's going to be about the dollars. It's going to be about balancing the budget. And I think some sacred cows in North Carolina, state government services, and the university system are really going to hurt this year when it's all said and done, because they're big budget items, and so you need some cuts. That's where you go, you know.
Well, I think that's not really a surprise, at least in general terms. Everyone in Chapel Hill knows that there will be some budget cuts that affect the university. So why is it what are you telling us that we don't already know?
Well, I think the interesting psychology with the recession is I think a lot of people have been holding their breath. Well, how long can you hold your breath? Mm-hmm. You know, that's the question. 2 years, 3 years. And I think the philosophy has been do more with less, and that's going to get to be do less with less. Mm-hmm. And so
our feeling over here, Tom, helping me with this, is that while Republicans, Democrats, Republicans are for less government, but nevertheless, Republicans as well as Democrats are appreciative of the contributions that the university and the university system have made to North Carolina. So nobody's going to put them out of business.
No, they won't. Of course not. And they won't put them out of business, but you get a different philosophy, DG. You get more of a zero-based budget philosophy, which is let's pretend it wasn't there and let's say exactly how much money do we absolutely need to keep the doors open and the lights on and do what we've been doing. And that's a different whole philosophy than let's see what we did last year. Can we build on it or do we just cut it a little bit? I think this crowd goes in on let's take nothing for granted and look at everything as if we've got a budget on one hand and we've got a program on the other. How do we match them up together? And what happens there, the difference when you talk about zero-based budgeting, you pretend I've got a pile of money over here. What can I do with it? Not I've got a bunch of programs over here. They cost X. How can I get to X? So it really is a different mindset. And, you know, they talk about laying off as many as 8,000 government employees. They talk about 4,000 people in the university system. Whoo, boy, that for the first time, that gets into bleeding. You know, that really hurts because you've got people who thought they had lifetime job security that are going to be looking for work. And that's really not happened before.
Well, you're familiar with the way universities work and the kind of special protections that different university employees have, the tenure and contractual obligations that are, you know, a part and parcel of the work of the university. So there's some limits on some employees or faculty members or staff members in terms of not being able to come in and either fire them or dramatically reduce their salaries without special rules being followed, which might mean that others unprotected by such customs and contracts will have to bear a heavier load.
So, a lot of that's already been done in the cuts that have happened so far, but that means, you know, no teaching assistants, no secretary to do the typing, no Xerox machines to do the copying. I mean, all the infrastructure stuff just gets nailed down to the bone because a tenured professor is a tenured professor. But that tenured professor is not getting a 2% raise either. And so what they end up doing is taking all the money that surrounds that tenured professor, from research support to infrastructure support to travel to academic conferences, and all that just goes away. So that professor just sits, has an office, a space, and a little more.
There's some notion, I think, over here that in Chapel Hill and maybe on the other campuses that, you know, things are going to get better. The economy is going to get better.
Right.
If we can just kind of hold on, beg, borrow, and steal, juggle, and hold on for another year or so.
Yeah, exactly.
Then,
how long?
Then the money in the state coffers will be back. And is that just dreaming, you think?
Well, DJ, if you look at other states, we work for the University of Illinois. Last year at the University of Illinois, there was $450 million that had been voted and appropriated by the state that did not come out of the state coffers to the university because the state did not have the money. Now, they held their breath. They borrowed. They borrowed against real estate. They borrowed money to run the flagship university of the state. And then this year, just recently, in the state legislature, they increased income tax, personal income tax, and corporate income tax in order to balance the budget in the state of Illinois. Now, people in North Carolina couldn't dream of having to do that, you know, because who wants to say I raise taxes, you know? But there's going to come a point where you find, I mean, the University of Illinois, you couldn't move because you couldn't afford to walk. It was because there was no cash. There was no money transferred from the state.
Well, what did, using that as sort of an example of what could happen in North Carolina, what did they do, and how did they survive that time when they had absolutely no money? What happened?
Well, they did a lot of creative things. I mean, they put off vendor payments, and they stretched out normal payments, and they froze activity, and they froze travel, and they froze support, and they didn't replace people who had left. And, you know, they just cut it right to the bone and held their breath. If they had not passed those tax increases, I don't know. I mean, the university would have started closing down departments. And you've already heard, I mean, Erskine Bowles, before he left, said this may affect schools, you know, and people said, you know, still in a little bit in denial. Wow, what's Erskine talking about? Erskine's trying to scare us. No, he's not. You know, do you ask the question? Do we need 16 universities supported by the state? You know, so. I think some real hard questions will be answered in the next year. And some people, the questions they never dreamed would be asked.
Well, it's interesting. I mean, people like you raise, and President Bowles raised the possibility to discuss closing a campus of the university system. And you, what happens when you start measuring the cost of these cost savings ventures? You find out that you don't really save all the money that you think. But in the case of closing a campus, all of these campuses are growing, that is, in student population, so that if you close one of the smaller campuses, say a campus that has 5,000 or 6,000 students, you have to figure out a way that the other campuses can absorb those students in terms of considering additional classroom space, places for the students to live, and particularly if you're bringing them from some distant campus. So all of a sudden, you've got to create an infrastructure, and you find out that you're spending more money than you would have if you hadn't closed the campus.
Well, you're right, with a couple of exceptions. You remember, part of the system are specialty schools like North Carolina School of the Arts or North Carolina School of Science and Math. I mean, if you close North Carolina School of Science and Math, high schools are going to absorb those kids. Mm-hmm. And they were in high school before they came there. If you close the North Carolina School of the Arts, sure, the other schools will absorb them, but that won't be quite as dramatic as you're talking about. Now, of course, if you close a campus in a city, how does the city make up for that? Because these are great economic engines for a lot of the cities, with the employment and other things that come from them. That would be a little more dramatic.
We're visiting with Tom Drew, one of my favorite guests, who's an expert on politics, fundraising, Duke and Carolina basketball. We'll talk about all those things after we come back from the short break.
Who's Talking is brought to you by University Square, a collection of locally owned high-end shops and restaurants offering unique products and free storefront parking. Visit University Square on Franklin Street, downtown Chapel Hill. University Square. See you there.
Now, here's D.G. Martin on WCHL.
Welcome back to Who's Talking. D.G. Martin. My guest is Tom Drew from over in Durham from 501c3 Solutions, and in your fundraising and consulting business. We'll talk about that maybe sometime, but I want to continue talking about politics and sports first. On politics, you do a lot of work in Washington, and you're plugged into the national political scenes and got friends on all sides.
Right.
And what talk about where the nation stands politically and where the battle lines are drawn, and is it different? Do you see things differently post 2008 and 2010 than you did before the Obama election and then the recapturing of the resurgence of Republican control in 2010? What is the landscape like?
Well, it is different. The president's different. I mean, you see him last week embracing Jeffrey Immelt and making him chairman of an industry committee.
Who's that?
He is the CEO of General Electric. But he's also a member of the Ronald Reagan Presidential Foundation board, and is a leader in corporate America, which being CEO of General Electric. So there is a general sense that, like Bill Clinton did after his midterm election, the president is going to move closer to the center. He's going to try to work with the House on health care reform and find some middle ground on things like that. He is going to be cautious about his relations with Afghanistan and Iraq, because conservatives are very comfortable with following what the generals suggest in both of those cases. So Washington is a different place, because think about this. In order to pass legislation, you have to pass a conservative House and a weakened Senate, And so
from the president's point of view, he can't take hard charging control of the legislative process. Well, let me approach it this way. Let's take both sides of it and pretend, first of all, that you're a consultant for the Republicans and you're looking for a presidential candidate who can beat Obama. What are the qualities of potential Republican presidential candidate that you'd want to match up against Obama? And then who are some of the people who might fill that bill, and how would you get them nominated in today's environment?
Well, fiscal conservative is going to be first, you know. So, and then someone who can be very articulate on foreign policy will be kind of the second thing that you would look for. And I think that kind of articulation on foreign policy would be someone who is more of an a little more of an isolationist and doesn't believe that the United States is the, owns the world police force and needs to go everywhere and do everything. I think those would be the two biggest things, you know. So, of course, you've got to look at a person like Mitt Romney, you know, as a serious potential Republican contender. I think, of course, popular and the news magazines and papers are going to push the Sarah Palin candidacy, but there's a general feeling that she will stub her toe somewhere along the line and not be a serious candidate. You know, there are even people who are talking about her last stumble, you know, was she set up by the Democrats or the Republicans, you know. And you have some bright new stars on the scene like Scott Brown from, you know, Massachusetts. And I think that's kind of what you would be looking for
so
in a Republican.
So if you're the consultant looking at it right now, all you've got is Mitt Romney? Is that
well, all you got that's clearly recognized. I think what you're going to find is some of these governors are going to pop up and, you know, anything from Bobby Jindal from Louisiana to even some of the senators and congressmen.
You sound like a football coach who recently didn't have all that good a recruiting year and yeah. trying to put together a team with a second-rate.
Well, that's exactly right. See, the interesting thing, well, think about this, DJ. The Republicans had one of the greatest victories ever in the history of the Republican Party and threw out their chairman. Now, what does that tell you? all the Republicans felt like that's what should happen. So how do you take – you talk about your coach, the coach who just had the biggest victory and they fired him.
Republicans – I mean, this arguably you look like you're uncomfortable being the Republican coach.
I am.
basically, you don't have the horses in a race that you might arguably be able to win, that you've got the strongest wind blowing at your back and you just don't have
they're in
the
clear. No,
you don't
no.
have a sail to
it's not clear who on the backstretch is going to take the lead.
I wonder, is there a General Eisenhower out there somewhere?
That's a real good question.
You and I understand that, but a lot of people weren't alive when the Republicans nominated someone who didn't have a history with the party, but
right.
was just kind of brand new but fresh, independent, came in to rescue a party that otherwise might not have been competitive in that election. Who can you dream of? Who would be that another military figure?
It's hard to imagine.
Petraeus
perhaps, but it's not that they can show a great track record either. You know,
We don't have any national heroes like we did after World War II.
I don't think so. I mean, who are you going to say? They sure did a good job in Iraq. I mean, they're spending a lot of money, you know. Wow, they sure did clean up Afghanistan, you know. Well, So that's, I think that's a real problem. It is strange. It's a strange time because, like I said, the Republicans just had this grand victory, just took over this great power. But, you know, it's like me asking you, who is the leader of the Tea Party? Who is the leader of the Tea Party? Michelle Bachmann? I mean, who is the leader of the Tea Party? Did you know that there are two Tea Parties?
Well, I didn't know that there was a single Tea Party. I thought it was just a way to describe a group of people who were very good at articulating what they didn't want, but positively unified in terms of coming up with an agenda that they did want. But not to say that it's not effective, because really what we're moved, I guess, as political animals, more by what we don't want than what we do want.
Well, that's exactly right. But there actually were three organizations that influenced the Tea Party. There was a 527 committee, which is a political committee called Tea Party Express out of Northern California. And then there was a Tea Party Patriot group that actually organized groups of people. And their chairman is in Atlanta, and their treasurer is in California. And it is weaker from a money standpoint. And then one of the strongest hands in the glove behind the Tea Party is Charles and David Koch out of Kansas, because their own 501c4 has paid staff almost in every state. And they have been supporting Tea Party efforts, although they're not called the Tea Party. So, you know,
let me before we take a break, and then after the break, I'm going to ask you to talk from the Democratic side.
Sure. But,
you talk about organizing these pockets or these mountains, I guess, of discontent in the country, and how the brand name of Tea Party is dispersed, and we don't really know what it is. But there are groups, for instance, in North Carolina, what we call, I guess, the Civitas or the John Locke group associated with Art Pope, who, like these two brothers, what is there the two brothers out there that you mentioned who support the Tea Party?
Sure, Charles and David Koch.
Yeah, the Koch guys who just have a phenomenal, and you'd have to say public-spirited commitment to a political life, and are willing to, more than the rest of us, they're willing to put their personal assets to work, and Art Pope is willing to do that with his family's assets and made a big difference in North Carolina. So far as you know, is there any connection between Tea Party and the Civitas groups? They're more organized and professional than the Tea Party, aren't they?
They are more organized. Well, yeah. Hard to say, DG. It almost depends on a case-by-case basis. I mean, they come together behind a candidate like Elmer's, and, you know, they're in sync.
This is the congressional candidate
that beat Bobby Etheridge. Yeah. And they're in sync, and they're multiple in money, and it comes together. Someone you've never heard of and hadn't been in politics all of a sudden defeats someone who is rock solid in the tradition of North Carolina Democrats. Mm-hmm. And throughout history, we see examples of that.
Well, I want you to put your Democratic hat on, and we'll talk about the problems and opportunities that Democrats might have in the next election. That's what I'm going to ask Tom Drew to do, my guest, after this short break.
Who's Talking is brought to you by University Square, a collection of locally owned high-end shops and restaurants offering unique products and free storefront parking. Visit University Square on Franklin Street, downtown Chapel Hill. University Square. See you there.
Now, here's D.G. Martin on WCHL.
Welcome back to Who's Talking. This is D.G. Martin, and Tom Drew is my guest. And I'm making him most uncomfortable pretending to be the leader of the American political parties. You stuttered when you talked about what you do as a Republican to take advantage of the openings that might be in 2012 now. So I'm going to let you take charge of the Democratic team. And what are your problems, and what are the achievable objectives that you might set for your party?
Well, that's not much easier, because the Democrats have a leader, Barack Obama, and
they've got a coach with a contract.
Exactly, you know, and he's got to play in the game. And people in the midterms were deserting him like, you know, he had the plague. And so the next 2 years are going to be very interesting on how he rebuilds his support. Now, he's going to do an awful lot of move-on strategy through the internet and through communications. He's got some very good backers in George Soros and other people like that. But bringing it back to North Carolina, what effect is the Democratic Convention going to have on North Carolina politics? Now, the irony is the Democratic Convention is going into the most Republican place in North Carolina, Charlotte, North Carolina.
Now, that's not true. I mean, Charlotte's got a Democratic mayor and a Democratic but it's got a lot of Republican strength.
It has Republican tradition. No other place in North Carolina can claim that. But that's right. But also then, if you say that the Democratic National Convention is coming into a state that where the governor is considered weak right now and vulnerable, well, is that going to help Beverly Perdue? I can't answer that. I mean, it's going to be a lot of publicity.
Yeah, there are two sides to that, and it's a great question. And one side is that Democrats are going to be happy, and we've got going to be talking about Democrats, and there'll be all kinds of things going on, and that will help the Democratic ticket. The other is that there's a longstanding tradition in North Carolina that Democratic statewide and local candidates have tried to distance themselves from the national candidates because North Carolinians don't think they've been in sync with the national Democratic agenda. But things are changing a little bit in that way, so that lore may or may not hold. We just, unless you've got better wisdom than I do, we just don't know how that's going to work.
We really don't know. But I mean, now what we've just declared, we don't know who the leader of the Tea Party is. We don't know who the leading candidate of the Republican Party is. We know Barack Obama's the leading candidate of the Democratic Party, but we're not sure we really want him in North Carolina to help Democrats.
So, well, what would you do? If you were counseling Beverly Perdue, since you won't take charge of the National Democratic Party right now, other than present the situation, what would you tell her? Would you say, Beverly, all in all, you're going to have to ride in the Barack Obama wagon anyway. You better get comfortable with that and take advantage of it and work to make that strongest? Or would you say, Bev, you got to cut your own, you just do your own job. You sell that. Don't look for any help and try to just do it on your own. Don't worry about the national party.
I find that people who run from a national party aren't able to run very far. And so I think the former, what you just said, I think if she would do almost, and I know we always hark back to this, we always have one, if she would do like Terry Sanford did with the Kennedy administration and say, look at the benefits to North Carolina by me being close to the president of the United States. And her number one thing is jobs, jobs, jobs. Now, she's been criticized because some people feel like the jobs are mostly minimum wage jobs, call centers, things like that. But if she could be able to say, look, if I wasn't close to President Obama, we wouldn't have this German auto plant, or we wouldn't have the Swedish technology company or something like that, then all of a sudden the concept of Beverly Perdue is enhanced by her relationship to the leadership in Washington.
So you think it's a saleable program for the gubernatorial candidate for the Democrats next year to say, here are things that North Carolina needs. And if Republicans win, we don't get them. If Democrats win, we do get them. You make your choice. That sort of.
That's right. I think you have to do that. I think you have to do it. I don't think you have any other place to go because you can't be a maverick, a singular independent person as a Democrat with, 40,000 Democrats coming into the state in July of 12, and everything building up to that. It would be very difficult for you to be independent of that. And so I think you have to go the other way. I think you have to really work and demonstrate to North Carolinians that being close to Washington, being close to the leader of the country is very good for North Carolina.
I'm just brainstorming, but the message is North Carolinians have always stood up to hard times and worked their way through it. The things that will help us to do that are this, this, and this. And if we can't get Democrats elected, we're not going to have those things, and we're going to have to continue to struggle. Republicans want to take these things away from you.
Exactly. Exactly.
Well, yeah. I tell you what, I'd love to talk about politics the whole time, but I promised everybody that you'd give us the inside scoop on athletics. So let's take a break and come back and talk about basketball. Tom Drew, and I'll be right back.
Who's Talking is brought to you by University Square, a collection of locally owned high-end shops and restaurants offering unique products and free storefront parking. Visit University Square on Franklin Street, downtown Chapel Hill. University Square. See you there.
Now, here's D.G. Martin on WCHL.
Welcome back to Who's Talking. This is D.G. Martin. My guest is Tom Drew. And Tom, thanks for, I know not a lot about more about politics, thanks to your wisdom and insight. Can you deliver for us the same sort of analytical commentary about sports? And let's talk about Atlantic Coast Conference basketball.
Oh, boy, that's great. I love talking about
that. Everybody's saying the Atlantic Coast Conference is so weak this year, so mediocre, that it's hardly worth watching. And that's kind of an insult to us, isn't it?
I think that is an insult. It's weaker than it traditionally has been, DG, for a lot of different reasons. I mean, I think all the major conferences probably, except for the Big East, and we used to not think the Big East was a major conference. But, I mean, if you look at the
Big East, according to that argument, they got raided by the Atlantic Coast Conference and came out stronger, at least in basketball.
That's right. And the Big Ten and the Southeast Conference all have their problems this year, too. I think we're seeing the ripple effect of kids leaving early. We've had a lot of coaching changes in the ACC when you think about it. You know, we have a new coach at Clemson. We have a new coach at Boston College. We have a second-year coach at Virginia, you know, and so a first-year coach at Wake Forest. So anytime you have a coaching change, you get a two-year gap before they're back to where they were at least. And so some of that is caused by that. I think the coaching and the play in the ACC is still fascinating. I mean, they're obviously three strong teams. Duke, which had their usual mid-January slump against St. John's and then played probably their best game without Kyrie Irving against Maryland, is solid. It's a solid top 10 team and will be a top 10 team all year. It really looks like since the first week of January, the freshmen have learned what Roy Williams wants and are giving it to him. And so now you see Harrison Barnes and Reggie Bullock coming on, and Marshall is the starting point guard. And it's a beautiful thing to watch when you watch Roy Williams, because Roy takes what Coach Smith taught him to the optimum. I mean, and that is ball pressure. And when I say ball pressure, it's both defense, which most people think of as ball pressure, but it's offense too. Roy pressures the ball on defense, but he pressures the rim on offense.
What do you mean by that? What does that mean?
He gets the ball down the court quicker than any team in the country, you know? And that's why he loved Ty Lawson. And when you think back to the tradition of Carolina, remember, Roy was on that bench when Phil Ford did it, and he was on that bench when all the point guards, Kenny, the Jet, yeah. I mean, but that was the deal. Get the ball down the court, because if you outrun the defense, you've got great opportunities. That was what Coach Smith's philosophy was. If you outrun the defense, you have great opportunity. Roy is a master of that. Now, the problem you have, DG, and you see this problem early with Carolina, they're over it, I think, now. You see this problem still with NC State, is the kind of kid who's coming into college right now. And it's the AAU kid. And let me tell you what that means. Since the eighth grade, these kids have been playing AAU basketball. Now, the positive of AAU basketball is they get to play a position that they'll play in college. In other words, a 6'4 player doesn't have to play center as he may have for his high school. He can play small forward or big guard. But what that also says, though, is you end up having to take out the AAU culture of these kids. Let me tell you what that is. AAU teams do not care if they win or lose. They are there for show. They are there for the stage for their kids to demonstrate ability. What that means is they don't concentrate on team defense, help defense, full court presses. They don't concentrate on extra passes, 10-foot shots, offensive schemes. What they concentrate on is show. And so you get kids, and you really see this at NC State, coming out of the AAU system, it takes them a while to learn the college system. You've got to play team defense. Well,
let me just end it. So I want you to keep on talking about this, but just to make the point, your point is that you can't take freshmen and have them play in a Roy Williams-type system the first day, the first week, the first month, maybe even the first half of a season, but that over time, with consistent drill and coaching, they get comfortable
they get
in
the
system, and they don't have to think about it. They
instinctively
run up and
down do it.
Court,
mm-hmm.
And it's like a wave, a consistent wave, rather than just a bunch of individuals kind of looking for where they're supposed to go.
That's right. I mean, you know, when a ball comes off a rim and a Carolina guy gets a rebound in practice, screaming in his ears is, go, go, go! The pass is faster than the dribble. Go! You know, so when he gets in the game, you don't want him to get the rebound and think, now what am I supposed to do with it?
This makes a lot of sense to me and helps me see sort of the early part of the Carolina system where a lot of bad passes, a lot of miscues, a lot of not knowing exactly what to do.
That's right.
Feeling like you got to do something.
That's right.
And your point is all of that was coming out of the coaching, but it wasn't working because the guy it wasn't systematic.
That's
correct.
It wasn't
automatic.
That's right. It wasn't instinctive. You know, so the whole purpose of practice and practice the system is where you don't even know you're doing it anymore. You've done it so many times, so many days during the week that in the game, you just do it.
Well, does that have anything? The shooting seems to have improved with the younger players in the latter part of the season. And I see how systematically that works. But it looks like a good shooter is a good shooter.
But before January 1, Harrison Barnes and Reggie Bullock weren't good shooters.
That's what I mean. But you know, they were good shooters.
Well, because they catch the pass and they think, now according to practice, what am I supposed to do with it now? Oh, I think I'm open. Well, maybe not. And I don't have to tell you, did you? If you have to think on a basketball court, you're a step slow. You know?
Well, now, if all of this is to say that Carolina is getting better.
That's right.
That Duke is already solid and presumably also getting a little better, but incrementally better, but not dramatically better like Carolina is.
Well, Duke gets dramatically better when Kyrie Irving comes back.
And fits back into the system.
That's correct.
Well, is that going to be a problem for Duke when
I think against Maryland, what you saw for the first time was Tyler Thornton starting at point guard. And that has two bearings. The immediate bearing is that lets Nolan Smith not guard the point guard and play off the ball on offense. And it also preserves the position for Kyrie Irving to walk right back into.
And that's going to really make – at least that's the hope of the Duke fans.
That's correct.
That really makes a dramatic difference. So Duke will be even better, getting better – even better.
If Kyrie comes back.
And now
there's a good chance he will.
Looking at the potential, say, for Carolina.
Sure.
You're saying they're improving dramatically, but they're not going to ever improve enough to be – I mean, they on a given night, they can beat Duke. But But in terms of
– Well, I don't know. Their January has been a real good time for them. I mean, their losses were, for the most part, before January 1. And so they are clicking more as a team. The players, the Leslie McDonalds of this world, are learning their roles. They're learning what they can do and what they can't do. And,
but they're still young. So they're not.
Everybody's
totally,
young, though.
They're not
everybody's
totally integrated
young.
Into the
That's
system.
True.
And how long does it take to get adjusted to the
Well, we'll see. I mean, we'll see. I mean, I think they're the hottest team in the conference. They were 4 votes out of the top 25 in mid-January. And, you know, by the time we're sitting here talking, they may be in the top 10. I mean, they're that good.
Well, now, what about the other strong teams?
Well, Florida State is strong because it has good athletes and good leadership on their team. But on the road, you know, they can lose to Clemson. And
so they can win or lose, and we'll do that the rest of the season.
I think so.
And by the time the tournament comes, Duke is going to be unbeatable, is it?
No, I don't think Duke will be unbeatable. I mean, that will really depend on Kyrie Irving. I mean, if Kyrie Irving's back and in full stride, Duke's unbeatable. But without that, they're still a little vulnerable on the edges, you know. I think Krzyzewski likes his team a whole lot, and he's got a lot of different weapons he can use.
What about at the end? Is Duke likely you would bet on Duke as your top candidate to win the national championship?
That's hard to say. Does Duke have the best team? I don't know. I've seen San Diego State, and when they shoot really well. I've seen Kansas. Kansas is awfully good and big and deep. You know, Ohio State, of course, is Ohio State. They're young, but Salinger, the freshman, is just very good. He's a very good player. And you've got to figure that teams that have had their ups and downs like Michigan State or Connecticut at the end of the year will be there, and magic could happen. I mean, the seas parted for Duke last year. Nobody would have picked Duke on their brackets to win a national championship. I don't know anybody who claims they did, you know. But everything fell into place, and the two best teams in the country, Kansas and Kentucky, got beat. And so, it could have been argued that Duke did not have to beat a top 10 team to all the way through, not a top 10 team, you know. So
there has to be some crossing the Red Seas.
No question.
In the championship. Well, golly, we got lots to talk about. Tom Drew, great to talk to you about politics. And I told you we'd talk about fundraising so you could promote your business a little bit, but you don't need it. You're way too busy. Thanks for taking time.
Hey, thank you, DJ. You always have a great time.
Busy schedule to visit with us. Thanks to all y'all for listening. I ought to remind you that if you miss a Who's Talking program, you can go right to the WCHL webpage and find any of the many programs we've done over the past few years, and I invite you to do that. In the meantime, thanks for listening, and I'll be right back here very soon. Take care.